This is the Goalkeepers Union Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union Podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with this week's guest, who is a man ensconced in everything goalkeeping, from consecutive appearances in non-league to coaching at the very top with Newcastle. He scoured the globe to further enhance a skill set saturated in the tactical, the technical, physical and psychological. He's an author, a keynote speaker, a DVD producer and a coach whose work, according to the late Sir Bobby Robson, was a privilege to endure. Simon Smith, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you on. Thank you for sparing your time and allowing me to be in your lovely living room right now.
Absolute pleasure, Matt. When you've introduced me there, I didn't recognise myself half of the time, so that's very kind.
We've got a lovely view here. I can see some water, which is just beautiful. I can see some sand. Just explain to me, where are we right now?
We're in Tynemouth, obviously overlooking the River Tyne, which has obviously been quite special to me over the years. Obviously I've been at the club for most of my career, and I've been really, really lucky in that point of view, because I'm actually probably one of the few people who had a longevity, if that's the right word, staying at the same club, as working at the academy. Obviously, I left then, first team goalkeeping coach, then I left, went to the FA, but I'm still based at home, and then obviously going back to the football club. So it's been a great base, and like you say, it's a lovely place to live as well.
Yeah, a lovely spot. I can just imagine having a nice coffee here, looking out over the water. It's beautiful. So we're going to get into so much to do with your career and goalkeeper coaching. I know that you've got plenty to talk about, a bank of knowledge, a wealth of experience, but we start every podcast with some quick fire questions, which depending on the answers can sometimes end up being long fire and spark a wider debate, but we'll see how they go. So the first one is, what gloves did you wear as a goalkeeper?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. And I was wondering if I was thinking about this the other day, because whether this was just me, I actually had favourite goalkeepers and followed their glove choice. So I had Pat Jennings was a favourite of mine. So that was an old sport guy. Bruce Grobbelaar was another favourite, brought something. He was different and special and a bit wacky, but Umbro. So I had old sport Umbro. And then as it went on, Adidas became they weren't really a brand to start off with for goalkeeping, but then Adidas came. And then this is sounding like just a list of goalkeepers, but it's not. David James Puma, and then Buffon Puma. So that, yeah. So I really had quite a broad spectrum. And well, I have to say, I was still playing, but I'd started coaching. I worked for Sondico.
Right.
So, or however you pronounce that. So that was another brand that came in just because you got them for free. That's an awful thing. But no, as I say, that's the way that my glove adventure started, was really by what other people wore.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And so those are gloves as they were. So I'm guessing that is the 80s, the 90s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I know that you've spoken quite openly about the modern glove. Where do you stand on these new designs?
I didn't want to be controversial, but there's two bits to it. I get the close fit modern glove. To me, it's a way of manufacturers not putting as much foam on the glove.
Okay.
So when Simon Smith goalkeeping first started, I was sponsored by Adidas. So it was a football club. That's where the connection came from. In fact, in the shed, I've got a bag of Adidas finger saves. They gave me the bits. So I have the bits of it. So I have a palm, I have the plastic, I have all the bits, so that they could show me how they made them. So, and then what they did was they said, on your courses, we'll give you the gloves for free. You get the kids to wear them. And they paid me for getting the gloves on the hands of young goalies. Finger save I'm talking about now. So for a morning's work, it was X amount for a whole full day, but they obviously had to give you the gloves back. And that corresponded with a time when both Shea Given and Steve Harper were Adidas guys. So I would have to say probably every kid, I asked them once, I said, can you tell me what your sales figures are for the northeast of England? Because every child that I seemed to coach or watch or whatever had Adidas finger saves. Yeah, so that was the kind of, with that, that was an involvement and a start. Some people love them, some people hate them. We then went into roll fingered gloves, so much better feel, more contact with the ball. So I used to wear finger saves for training and then roll fingertips for matches because they got a better feel. Yeah, and then as I said, as it's gone on and they've evolved, it's like, why have they evolved? For me, they were good then. But as I say, I just feel when I look at some of them now and they go on about lightness and, you know, you don't need the rubber here because, as I say, I feel it's because they're expensive even to manufacture and it's a way of not having as much foam on your palm.
Interesting. Okay.
I might be wrong there, but when I look at them now, and I have had some, it's just, yeah, right. Well, why is the, I think I'm going to say this. I think part of it comes because they're designed by people who don't really play the game.
Hmm.
I mean, I had a really interesting, Adidas sponsored Simon Smith Goalkeeper and then Sells, I did with Adam, so which was great. And then for whatever reason, when I left, I went to Nike. And through the Nike thing, which was excellent, I got involved in strobe goggles, which basically, as the thing suggests, they produced a pair of sunglasses, basically, where the lens is flicked on and off. So you could see the ball, you couldn't see the ball. Obviously, the idea was that when they stop flashing and you see the ball, it's like, whoa, this is great, you know.
Yeah.
So I got invited to Portland, to the headquarters, and to see these glasses, and Dr. Ali was called, ran it through me, and the principle of it, fantastic. I'm wearing them, and, you know, and I had these other things, you know, like the Patak boards.
Yes, yeah.
Show really how it worked and what the principles of it were. And as I say, we ended up wearing these glasses. You could vary the speed, so they either flicked on and off really slowly or really quickly. So obviously, as the ball's traveling to you, you saw it in 5 meters away, 3 meters, 1 meter, then it's in your hands, and then they could do it left eye, right eye. But what they'd forgotten to do, which is a great idea, but what they'd forgotten to do was to write a program for it of how we would actually implement the goggles, which I thought they spent all of this money. But that was my first experience of, and then I had a friend, Paul Winsper, who was a fitness coach in Newcastle United, now works for Under Armour. He got me in front of a panel of Nike executives who were responsible for soccer. So I was the guy from the Premier League, which still to this day is a bit of a, so I went in front of these people. As I say, they are were heads of football for Nike, all the rest of it. And the conversations kind of went, I said, there's two classic football boots in the world, Puma King and Adidas Copa Mundial. They said, well, we make them plastic because then we can make them different colours. That was actually their rationale for football boots. Not the fact, I had no idea that, you know, you had to kick it at 70 mile an hour and then we got onto goalkeeping gloves. And one of the guys actually said, I was telling him about the games, about how they water the pitch. He said, do you play in the rain? Which if anybody has experienced a night goalkeeping glove, there's something in that. Because in the dry or the damp, they're fantastic. In the wet, sometimes not so clever. And I've always remembered that conversation with that bloke. And I thought, I'm still not quite sure, because the majority of their market being in the US, I would suspect, they play in the dry.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, right, they would never know that they've played in the rain. And as I say, it's always been one of them things that I'm surprised that they've kept going in the goalkeeping glove market. I really am. I mean, I always remember speaking to Adidas about the goalkeeping department, and it was like 0.05% of their turnover. And I'm being really keen and saying, oh, you should do this, you should do that. What about this? And then one day, Adidas people said to me, well, and I'm going back to probably the 90s now. We have a glove designer. So I said, a goalie, like, I think it's going to be Oliver Kahn or somebody like that. And they said, well, actually, he does motorbike things, motorbike gloves. But we've got him in now and he's doing goalkeeping. And it's like, right, okay, then. You know, it's like, But as I say, I'm hoping that it's moved on since then. But
yeah.
When I look at some of them, I'm not so sure. And obviously, Roach with the skiing, you know, because to be fair, Roach was always one of those people where they used to tell you that they made the gloves for everybody else. And right at the start, I'm going back. You know, once we got past the green cotton and the Gordon Banks with the table tennis bat on, they always used to say, oh, well, you know, Roach make all the gloves in anyway. Okay. And then obviously, Old Sport appeared and they were kind of a glove manufacturer, which went into goalkeeping. So I've been fascinated, as you might tell, I've been fascinated by the glove thing.
Yeah.
Fascinated by the glove. And as I say, I've had some lovely opportunities to get more involved with things. And as I say, it's been revolutionary, really. You have to say, don't you? And I
absolutely
wonder what happens next. Is it going to be, well, it'll never go back to no gloves, but, you know, will it go full circle? And so people start to say, oh, well, yeah, as they still do a finger save, but like with a negative cut.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, all right, okay then. I mean, we had some weird wonder family. Sheikh and was an Adidas man and then decided to go to Sondico. And obviously Sondico didn't do a finger save. So we had a period where they really were top pair of gloves with shin pad stiffness that they had managed to get made specially. And it's like...
Because he was big for finger saves, wasn't he, Shea Given?
I think he just felt that it kept his hands in a nice natural catching position. And yeah. And then they used to crack, when if it bent the wrong way, they would crack.
Mm.
So it's like, oh, is that not a bit dangerous?
So we got, have you got deconstructed finger save gloves somewhere in this house?
In the shed.
Fascinating. Brilliant.
I've got a Sondico Shea Given with plastic stiffness. Which I've kept. I haven't kept many, but just the odd one or two. And again, Matt, it's like, it's not a secret now, but you got it right from the start where the ones that the professionals wore weren't the same. So like, because of the Adidas thing, I would get a pair of Jersey Dudex and you looked at the palm and the palm were just like pure rubber.
Mm.
Had no additives, nothing. Unbelievably sticky when they were wet, but fell apart after like two shots.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? But that's what they can afford to give them to him because, you know, he's wearing 12 pairs a season.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Kits. Let's move on to kits. Your favourite kit over the years?
I had a bit of an odd one. I always liked Schumacher, the German goalie,
mm-hmm.
and I loved the sky blue kit that he wore. Sky blue tops, shorts and white socks. Like you could never get it. You could never find one anywhere because it wasn't that relevant in those days. And anyway, I had a friend, Mark Miller, still got a friend, Mark Miller, who lives in Malta, played in Malta, managed in Malta, still lives there. He managed to find me one from there. Kind of got there at the time. I think the Maltese national team was sponsored by Adidas, and he managed to get me a Harold Schumacher Adidas top. It had the Maltese cross on, which I wasn't really bothered about. But yeah, and then I had a blue Adidas top, which was kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. I'm going back to early Oliver Kahn, where it was kind of a blue with a jazzy pattern. There's a jazzy pattern on the front.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's been some other classics. There was a Newcastle goalie top, which was blue, royal blue with the Newcastle Brown Ale star on, white stripes on a black sleeve. So I have a shirt from every season that I was there the first time.
Oh, fantastic.
So again, in the shed, in a box, yeah. I've got some horrific ones, I've got to say. Like there was a one which was plain orange where it had big stripes on the arms. There was a purple one with a black pole in it.
Mm.
Dreadful.
Yeah.
But there are some absolute classics.
Well, that is, I mean, it's nice to keep hold of things, but that's a retirement package down there, I tell you, if you ever want to get rid of them. Saves, the most memorable save that you've made.
Oh, that I've made?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was lucky enough, obviously started at Newcastle as an apprentice and then had an injury crisis. I got in the reserves and we played Liverpool at St. James's Park in the old Central League. So when Newcastle played Liverpool away in the Football League or whatever it's called then, there was a reverse fixture. So we played Liverpool at the time. I think about there was about 5,000-6,000 people came. And Liverpool's team, looking back now, was a bit of an all, even in the reserves, is like an all-stars. Like Steve Ogrovich played in goal. Dave Watson, not yet. So Dave Watson, who ended up a coach at Newcastle, who lives just around the corner, he played and obviously went on to captain Everton, played for England. Sammy Lee, Ronnie Whelan. Anyway, where I'm alluding to was Ian Rush played up front, and I made a save off Ian Rush where I was running one way, then the ball came in from across, and he managed to get his toe on it, and I managed to stop myself and go the other way, and save it. And I think we actually won 2-1. And that sticks. That it was probably one of the best ones that I've made because you don't quite wasn't really expected.
Mm.
Wasn't really expected.
Two more. We'll do these ones quickly. And you've already alluded to a few of these names already. Goalkeeping icon.
Well, obviously, Peter Shilton was probably a one as well. Again, Ulsport. So Peter Shilton, Pat Jennings, Bruce Grobbelaar, Neville Southall. Sounds like I'm just listening. And then obviously a bit later on, there was Peter Schmeichel. I'm probably missing somebody out. But they were the ones who you would look to. I mean, I'm going to say this, Matt. There was no like real goalkeeping coaching. So if you wanted to learn, you had to watch somebody else play. You know, if you had the pleasure of working with them, or, you know, I used to watch Football Focus or whatever it was called then, for like clips of goalkeeping. Again, in the shed, you would think I've got a massive shed, but in the shed, I've probably got videotapes with, you know, 15 minutes of Neville Southall training that was on Football Focus. That was how we kind of learned, say, because you hadn't either watching other goals was like the way forward. Match play, and if you could get a bit of clips in training to see what they were doing, then even better.
And the final one, the best goalkeeper you've worked with. This can be a goalkeeper that you've coached, a goalkeeper that you've played with, or even played against. I know that I'm putting you on the spot here because you've worked with a lot.
No, I know. I think from a watching and a longevity of playing at such a high level, I'd have to say Buffon. Obviously, we played against him, but just the way, I'm just going to say he was class. Both on and off the field. I've told the story about waiting for Steve Harper's shirt, where Harps wanted his shirt and he swapped and he made me wait, but then came back and apologised and gave me the shirt and all the rest of it. It was great. And then the way that he's managed to keep himself fit, I know he's had the odd wobble here and there, but the way he's managed to play at a level, such a high level for such a long time, it's overlooked in some ways. It's like, oh yeah, he's still, but to perform and train, probably not every day, but most days, and then still play at the level that he does. I just think is, and obviously what he's won as well. So there's background to it. It's just quite phenomenal, really.
Yeah, still playing. It's just remarkable, isn't it? Yeah,
remarkable. And I think the other one that stuck out for me, and this didn't actually come to me till a bit late, till actually, what, 4 or 5 years ago, was Iker Casillas. Because, Matt, the thing was, you know, I hit on a time in my playing career where, I am small for a goalie. So 5'10", and like to Bobby's day, we're talking about Laurie Civil and Paul Cooper and all the rest of it. 5'10", 5'11", Peter Shilton, Ray Clements, 6 foot-ish, if that. And then obviously that just disappeared. Got to be 6'2", 6'3". It seemed to get taller for a period. And then all of a sudden, we can't find anybody taller. Mm-hmm. But then we played Porto, and I was talking to Martin Dubravka on the trip. He said, he's always been a favourite of mine. Well, that's interesting. You know, talk through, play at the highest level, got in the team young, but nobody kind of mentioned that because they're just winning things and he's making unbelievable saves and all the rest of it. And then, say, playing Porto, and he's there at Porto at the time, and Martin goes over introducing himself. And I'm thinking, oh, this is great, really. This is Simon, my coach. And I'm now looking at somebody eye to eye and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, to play the level that you've played at, won what you've won, and you're 5'10". And it was a real kind of a fair play to you to be at the top level and do that.
Rips up the rule book, doesn't it, really?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit. So, yeah, I would say, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've worked with some other fantastic goalies, but those two kind of stick out for me.
Okay. Like I said, we're going to talk much about your coaching career, your coaching philosophy, your perspective on coaching now, how the art of coaching has evolved over the years in some ways, I guess. But let's very quickly touch on your playing career, just quickly, because the consecutive game stats is unbelievable. So correct me if I've got this wrong, but 405 games in a row you played. That was for Gateshead. So, I mean, I don't know if that's ever been done before or indeed since.
It was a real funny one, Matt, because you think, oh, I was at the same, I played all them games and I was at the same club. But because of the way that non-league football works, when a manager changed, the team changed. So within that span of games, I probably played for, I was thinking about this the other week, probably four or five different Gateshead teams. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because a manager would come and he'd been at Billingham Symphonia, is the example that I can think of. And then he brought 7 players from Billingham Symphonia. I remained, but he brought, so it was like playing for, yes, it's Gateshead, but it was really Billingham Symphonia Reserves or Revisited, you know? And as I say, that's a kind of, I mean, the other stat that I was thinking about the other day, I must have played with hundreds of people. Within Plymouth Gate said 400 times off, whatever. I must have played with hundreds. And it's like, But the actual playing thing, one, obviously I was very lucky that I didn't get injured. And that's really why it finished. I got a calf strain. I couldn't play. I tried to play, but I couldn't. And then they used to call me Simon Smith 7 because I was never great. And don't get me wrong, I made mistakes, which if I ever go and watch Gateshead, they remind me of one mistake in particular where I air-shotted the ball against Kidderminster. But which in another way, looking back now, that's quite nice because if you were there for that length of time, 10 years, 501 games, like you say, 400-odd consecutive, to be remembered for one error, I'm quite proud of quite proud of that, actually. But yeah, as I say, it was just, and the other side, I just kept playing.
So what was it, do you think, about the new managers that they saw in you? Was there something in you yourself?
I think I was just steady and reliable.
Yeah.
I think that was basically it. Didn't make too many mistakes. Steady and reliable and love. I don't know whether they see that, but you had it. I still have an enthusiasm for the game, the position. I don't know. And like you say, just pitched up every week, training.
Amazing. Well, I don't think we'll ever see it again. 310, Brad Freeland, the Premier League. I looked at another goalkeeper and it was Dave Besant. I could find 394 for 9 years across Wimbledon and Newcastle and Chelsea. But in terms of goalkeeping, yeah, I don't think we'll ever see anything like that again, really. But let's come on to your coaching career. So you've come through a period of goalkeeper coaching, like I said, a real transition, not a transition really, an evolution. But we'll get on to that. I guess now, just like to know how you are, really, post-goalkeeper coaching. You're in a new wave of life, I guess.
Yes and no. I mean, I think really, without going into too much detail, from doing it every day for, well, at least the last 7 years, and then stepping away from it, I've really had a time to look at it, think about it. Like I said, I've gone back to work for the FA part-time, so I've still involved in coaching as it is now, which has been really interesting. And maybe speaking to people that you never had time to speak to, like you say, sitting in this window with a cup of coffee, thinking about, I don't know, I got on about penalty saving. Somebody mentioned penalty saving. I was sitting here thinking about penalty saving and having it all written down on a bottle. But if they know you've got it written on a bottle,
I made this point the other day on our Between the Sticks podcast because I noticed it a lot in the Carabao Cup final with David De Gea, who was making it quite clear that he was checking his bottle before or as the attacker approached. So then, like you said, does that mean the attacker goes, okay, well, he thinks he's obviously got the stats which suggest I'm going to go to his right, so should I go to his left?
Yeah. So, I mean, going off the subject slightly, but the penalty thing is really interesting. So in my time at Newcastle, when I first got the job, I could still play or perform. So I used to join in training quite a lot. And on a Friday, Alan Shearer would want to take some penalties. Shane Harps didn't want to go in because he would either score or there was that familiarity with them. So he'd say, "Si, go on, get in." So I would go in and he'd tell me where he's going to hit it. And I've got to be honest, Matt, I was there for 5 years and I never saved one. Yeah. I didn't even get any, and even if I knew where he was hitting it, where I'm coming from is that, you know, and don't get me wrong, I could still play, but I'm limited, I'll say the word. But if they hit them with power and pace and in the right place, you're definitely struggling. But so that was an interesting from there. So it's like, well, okay, you can't say it to Shane Harps. Well, just dive and you might save it if he hits it badly. So there was that. So we went into a thing where, right, okay, if I could teach them to dive with no step from the middle of the goal to the post, then they've got a chance if they go the right way. So I'd kind of seen it at the top. I produced a technical practice. Well, I'm saying I did it. It was Pavel Cernicek. If you don't remember Pavel, some great ideas on goalkeeping because he came from the Czech Republic. Different. He was a great education for me. So I thought, right, if I can teach them to step and dive to cover the post, obviously you can't quite spring into the top corner, but you can definitely cover to the post. If you go the right way, then that's, so we're now splitting down the percentage or the, you know, you're giving yourself a better chance. And then I did loads of stuff on, which is still today, how they run up, how they approach the ball. Are you looking at above the ball Are you looking at their open knee? Are you looking at where their non-kicking arm goes? And it's been nice because over the years, and I've worked with different people, they've told me what they look for. And I'm not going to give it away now, but do you know what I mean? Mm. So I've had one where he said, well, if he opens his arm like that, normally with the chest open, he can go this way. And that's from goalkeepers, not coaches. So they've looked at it themselves. You know, if you approach the ball, can you kick it across yourself? Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing. So that was something else that before every game we went through, who's taken the penalties recently, which way they've gone. So we didn't have on a bottle, but we'd seen all the penalties. Yeah, obviously, what gets me now, I was aware I'm trying to come from, is like, if you've got it written on a bottle, they know you've got it written on a bottle. But sometimes I watch people and I don't think they're looking. It's like, yes, it says 40% are going to go bottom right. Well, I'm just throwing myself, and they just throw themselves. They don't actually look to where the ball's going either. Mm. You know what I mean? So like they're diving, but like, well, actually the ball's coming. You need to.
They're conditioned into just the way that they need to go.
And when they go the wrong way, it's like, oh, it's not my fault. It says on that bottle, he's always gone to the left. And then of course the latest, it's always been there, is that, so you dive and then they kick it straight down the middle. Now it takes a lot of bottle to stand still, but we always had that. That was one of the people I worked with, was to stand still as long as possible. So once you're standing, you've got to wait as long as possible and hope that you can leave it late. Look at his shape. Look at, you know, you've got the technique to get there if it's in a certain area. So yeah, it really has built. I mean, that obviously there's been loads of research on penalties because it's a closed skill, ball stationary, you're on the line. And then there's been the other side of it where I've had goalkeepers who are terrific at putting people off. And I'm not sure I actually want to say that, but just, and sometimes it's not by, there's a lot of, I would say not play acting, it's not the right word. I think there is a word, but it's not a nice word. But I can think of people that I've worked with who are really good at putting off the kicker, and not by rubbing the studs on the spot. Mm. I've just got something about them that puts people off. I'll give you Freddie Woodman, plays for Preston now. I had a place for England for me. Saved numerous penalties, I've got to say, in really important games. We won the European Championships under 17s in Malta, and I think he saved two or three in the final. And I still don't know. There was just something, either he had a great ability to read where the kicker's running to kick it or whatever, but he was terrific at putting them off. And when they ran up, you thought, I never ever used to say in professional football, I was going to save this. But with Fred, I actually thought he was going to save them. It was weird. But the other side of that is that it's international football. We used to practice penalties because it's knockout football. Like after every session, he would face, well, there'd be a squad of 18 or 20, and then they took one themselves. So every day he's facing probably 20, if somebody wants to have another go, 20, 25 penalties a day. And we're there for 4 weeks. Mm. So it's a lot. You know, in the end, because there was a familiarity, we actually borrowed two of Malta's goalies. And I'm talking Malta's proper goalies to come and do the penalties with our team. As I say, Fred's in there every day facing 25 penalties. And then obviously we're looking at the opposition and trying to fit it all together. So that's just one aspect of it that kind of has not come to me since I've left. But it's like, oh, right, okay then. Yeah, there's something I feel now people are missing.
Right.
And I'm not going to say that analysis has overtaken the actual technique, but I think there is a little bit of that.
Well, you can never practice too much. I don't think at all. And there's something in that in Freddie Woodman having that. Actually, we've seen it with Emi Martinez in the World Cup, of course. And unfortunately, the rules being what the rules are, they're trying to outlaw. Well, they will outlaw that for next season, which is a real shame. But I think we're going to see. Well, we are seeing more penalties hit down the middle. I think just this weekend, you saw Callum Wilson with his second for Newcastle at the weekend. You saw it in the conference playoff final. The lad from Chesterfield, his penalty went straight down the middle. So I think we're going to see more of that actually. And what you said about Alan Shearer too, so we're seeing it more in football now, Lee Grant being a good example at Ipswich, where he is working with the strikers to teach them more about goalkeeping.
Yeah.
Did you do that with the likes of Shearer? Were you having conversations with Shearer with regards to penalties or anything else about what a goalkeeper might do?
Because they're students of the game, they are already having the conversation.
Mm.
And I mean, the thing with Alan was he played in goal as a kid as well. So he had a bit of like, what does the other side look like? So, and to be fair, I've worked with a few outfield players who've had a go in goal, which has been an interesting thing to get the reverse.
So they've gone in goal to learn.
Look at Harry Kane. I mean, I only did probably three or four trips with him, but was interested in, well, what are you going to do? or even I'll go in, just have a look. He never saved it, but I'll go in and have a look. But we had a goalkeeping crisis in the Ukraine at the European Championships, and a lad called Henry Lansbury went in goal because we actually lost a goal. So we only had one. And I think it was Jason Steele, to be fair. But and Henry went in, and it's like, oh, right, okay, this is what it looks like, you know, from the other way around. Yeah, well, I've got to say the classic was Ruud Gullit. So Ruud would go in goal, and he'd save everything.
Really?
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, don't get me wrong, he was a perfect shape for a goalie, perfect size. But he just knew, he knew by the way they're running up or the way that their foot is behind the ball or to the side of the ball, he just knew where it was going. It was a trick. I summed it a couple of times, so it was like a trick. He could nearly tell you when they ran up where it was going to go, even if he couldn't save it. And he never used his hands, he always stopped it with his feet. Unbelievable, because he was so good at reading people's body language.
Do we see that as a good thing, about an annoying thing, that an outfielder's just gone in goal and is able to do that?
It just, again, Matty Gooch goes back to he's looking at the shape of the kicker.
Yeah.
So he's playing a midfield, he's one of the top players in the world. Is that why he's a top player? Because he reads other people, like a book, probably. So if you've got a goalie who reads people, and they're like I was saying, Freddie might be one. If you showed him a shape, a blacked out shape, he'd probably be able to tell you, have a good go where that's going to go. And to be fair, I've done some stuff with a tennis serving. So I looked at it from two ways. So I looked from receiving the serve, which is like shooting, you know, shot stopping. And I looked at serving. And then when you're receiving, so I play tennis, but I don't play tennis. I can get it over the net. And then you go and speak to the people who are experts at coaching tennis or playing. And they say, yeah, when they toss the ball up and the way that the racket head, you can tell where it's going. Well, I can't. But they can, because they see things much quicker than I do, and they know, and you get to know by experience. So when he throws a ball up, I'm just looking to see where it's gone. The receiver is looking at where his wrist is in his hand on the handle of the racket and where the head of the racket is. And then you say, how on earth did he get that back? It's anticipation.
Mm.
So, but not all of it. It's anticipation coupled with the speed. So there's fascinating crossovers, and that's what I always say, there's fascinating crossovers between goalkeeping and other sports.
And you've looked at other sports too. Cricket was one, right?
Yeah, so I went to do the cricket through a guy called Paul Farbrace, who was the assistant manager of England, was a goalie at Gillingham and as a kid, and then went to play cricket instead, and just came and said, can I come watch your work? Watched his work. I joined him in, and then he was like, oh, you need to come and speak to some of these cricketers. You know, so I went, and there are so many crossovers. It's crazy, and a lot of it, Matt, or not a lot of it. Some of it was actually taking the fear. So this is the first one I went to. They said, "Oh, the fast bowlers don't field. They just, when they've done their over and they're exhausted, I get it. Just go and stand out there." And said, "Well, that's great. But what happens if the ball comes and they just leave it and it goes for four?" Well, no. So I said, "Well, look, everybody needs to join in," and in the end. A lad called Stephen, who's a fast bowler and he played for England, and he ended up going in at the end of the session. We had a small side game. He was desperate to go in goal to try and put into practice what we'd done. And as I say, now that game is obviously 2020. Runs are a key aspect of it. What I like about cricket is if you drop it, you know, you can't drop it because the catch is everything. That's why I like it. And then obviously wicket keeping. When you're standing back, keeping wickets, just like shot stopping. And I didn't realise, I didn't realise how fast it's coming. You know, so, I mean, my first experience was Stephen Harmison used to come to do his winter training with us at Newcastle. And we had a game in the indoor at Newcastle with Harmison bowling to Shearer. And then there was a lad called Garrett Jones, who was a wicketkeeper for England. He came up to do some work with us. So he's behind the stumps, Army's bowling, Alan's batting, Gary Speed, God love him, and myself and a couple of others are fielding. And it's like, so Army said, I'm going to do a half run-up. I won't do the full run-up, just do the half. And he bowled this ball at Alan. And it's like, flipping heck, that's it, because if it hits him, he's going to kill him. The thing about that was that Garrett's standing up behind the wicket and he's caught it, because Alan's obviously missed it. He's caught it, and it's like, how do you call that? I just can't see that. So when later on I went to Kent to have a go with theirs, they put me behind the bowling machines and I've shouted it. I said, how fast? He went, 50, 70 miles. I said, 70 miles an hour, yeah. So I'm there with the glove. I had no pads on, no box on. I've got gloves on. And he's dropped the ball in at 70 miles an hour. And if it had hit me, it would have killed me because I never saw it. It just hit the wall. I was standing behind. There was a wall. And it's like, oh, my goodness gracious. I have no idea how fast it's coming and how they're just. So in the end, I was trying to teach Garrett Jones to, he couldn't dive to his left. So he led with his right hand. So he ended up on his tummy. So I said, no, no, you need to step with your, you know, your left and lead with your left hand. And if it's one-handed catch, that's what you're going to get. I actually couldn't do it with the pace of the ball. I couldn't do the technique quick enough to think. So in the end, I had to say, you know what the principles are, you know what I'm asking you, you know, can you have a go? And to be fair, it was like, oh, right. Because once he got the stepping off his right foot or left foot, he was great. And won the Ashes. And I was saying, that's me. But
yeah,
it's like, wowza.
I guess baseball is similar in a way to that, yeah, as well. I spent some time in New York last year and we went to Brooklyn Sluggers. So we were in the cages and wow, on the slowest speed, it was difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a thing with the weight baseball. Shea Given wanted to be able to throw the ball better. So we got him a Paul Barbrick, to be fair, got him a book on baseball throwing, stepping over the gate and release and all the rest of it. And it was like, all right, bore to it. It's like stand in front of the mirror, show us your shape. And then he'd say he'd come in on a Monday. So I've been in front of the mirror. I think I'm getting it. And to be fair, when you look towards the later time of our spell, he threw the ball lovely. And so I say, like, the crossover for it is, you know, about where they had, to be fair to England cricket, they also brought in people. So I went to Loughborough to watch a throwing coach from America who was working for them as a consultant. And he was, I'll never forget it. He came in, he had jeans and a T-shirt on. So we're in Loughborough's, like, the home of cricket. He come in, he was chewing tobacco. Well, he was chewing something. He was chewing tobacco. Typical American guy. Had his tracksuit top tied around his waist. Saying to the guys, this is what I want you to do. Blah, blah, blah. And he was chatting away and they had all the banter, all the American thing and all the rest of it. And it was like, it's a great talker, but can he do it? So anyway, it went on and the lads a bit short. So we would say, no, you're releasing it too early. And you think, oh, and then to be fair, maybe Matt Prior, to be fair, throwing this ball and it bounced short of the wickets. And it's only that 6 inches of a wicket, not the full thing. And it dropped short. I said, no, Matt, you need to let it go a little bit later. So he let it go a little later and it's hit the stumps. And it's like, oh, the guy obviously knows what he's talking about. He's really good. And then he's thrown another one he's missed. And so he said, hey, give me the ball. And so then the guy, the American guy's got the ball and he's just stepped into this throw and he's throwing it that hard. The wickets have jumped up in the air. He's actually knocked them up in the air. And it was like, I'm standing with Paul Barbrick. So he's like, all right, he doesn't know what he's doing. And he was excellent. It just, as I say, the crossover from sports. I'm not sure it works all the time, but if the player sees a benefit from it and they buy into it, it can be great.
So I think that leads us on nicely to where goalkeeper coaching is now and where it was when you first started out, really, in the early 90s. How do you feel like the position and the art of coaching has changed or evolved, like I said before, in that time?
If I go back to the start, like I said to you before, Matt, when I started, there was no goalkeeper coaching. So you really learned from, if I go back to my Newcastle days as an apprentice, so you were basically left to get on in your own devices, and then you would watch or work with the first team goalkeeper. So you would look and see what they did. And then, like you say, as it went on, I think a few managers had probably been abroad and seen that clubs abroad. I think it was something that started in Europe more than in the UK. That thing of having a specialist goalkeeping coach and then brought that back to the UK. And whether it started off, well, I can't think of many full-time. I think how it started was international teams probably got it first. So England had Mike Kelly with Sir Bobby. Hodgkinson did Scotland. Can't remember who did Ireland, but I think that's kind of like that former goalkeeper all started in international football. And then it started, there was like the job in goalkeeping coaches, and include myself in that, Freddie Barber, myself, Mark Prudhoe. Obviously there was Mervyn Day. So that's kind of how it started. And they would do, you know, like one day a week or just to give the goalkeepers something where they made them feel as though they were getting work, which was specific to the position. And then obviously as it's gone on over the years, well, I think if you look now, probably every team definitely in the Football League and the Premiership would have a goalkeeping coach. I mean, I follow LinkedIn and then I look in every day and it's like non-league clubs have now got them and then Sunday League teams have got them. And then obviously there's the the women's game, which is growing arms and legs, which is fantastic. Every women's club's now got a goalkeeping coach. So the availability of the job and the actual role has become massive. Yeah, which I'm going to say can only be in one way a good thing. It just worries me what they're delivering, if I'm being totally honest. That's the thing that, from a psych point of view, or from a, yeah, it's great because they have somebody to take an interest, somebody to tell them they're doing it right, somebody to help them. Like I was saying before, I might get shot down for this, I still feel that some coaches, managers aren't interested in goalkeeping. And I think that's another thing. That's why they want somebody to do it, so they don't have to deal with it. And at all levels, I'm not talking about in the Premier, I'm talking about like a non-league grassroots level. Say, oh, I don't know anything about goalkeeping. Well, so we've got somebody now. Whereas before, it was like, well, I don't know anything about goalkeeping, but you should have saved that.
Hmm.
All right, you said you don't know anything about it, but you should have saved it. Or she should have saved it. It's like, really? I think we've always been fighting about with that. Like I said, right, when I got the job with Sir Bobby, after, as I say, when I got the bottle to actually speak to him properly, I actually said to him one day, what are you actually looking for? And that came from sitting next to him on the bench. So there was Sir Bobby, John Carver, myself. And every time one of them made a mistake, not even a mistake, but just a decision that he didn't agree with or whatever, he would ask me or have a go. I'm going to say, have a go at me. It's like, Simon, what are you doing there? And it's like, well, actually need to know what you're looking for so that doesn't happen all the time, because it really did happen quite a lot at the start. In the start, it was quite, at the time, I wondered whether I was being bullied. But looking back now, I think he was trying to train me to know what he was wanting, if you know what I mean. Before I actually asked him, he was trying to tell me what he was in a roundabout way, because he was very much into that, helping coaches and all the rest, as we know, helping coaches and trying to help you to develop yourself. So that was an interesting one to as I say, as a learning thing. And then obviously over the years, I've had a few managers which are like Rafa, for instance, unbelievably knowledgeable and unbelievably enthusiastic about goalkeeping. Had I been less experienced, it could have blown me up and I might not have taken to him and it as well as I did. But I looked at it as an educational thing. He asked me questions. He wanted me to write I wrote every session down anyway, but to go over how long did I spend on each topic in goalkeeping. So how long did I do shot stopping? How many times did I do crossing? Either how long per day or how much produce at the end of the month a pie chart, so that the goalies knew that we'd done the right percentage of crossing, the right percentage of shot stopping, right percentage of 1v1, as an example. And then also how long I'd had them and how long they'd been with the team and what the theme of the team practice was. Now, that's kind of what they do now, but this was, for me, why he's a bit special, was ahead of the time. And him and Paco, his assistant, they'd built that on their success at Liverpool, also, I believe. So that, and this, to me, as an experienced goalkeeping coach, just brought a whole new, I think there's always been a thought, Matt, that in coaching, and when you're a goalkeeping coach, is you always coach to your strengths. So for instance, my strength obviously wasn't crossing, because I'm 5'10". I can jump, but it wasn't one of my stronger areas of play. So as a coach, do I want to do crossing? And then, but this, when you did the chart thing, it actually highlighted sometimes what you neglected. So 1v1 would be one that I would have neglected, because apart from you being the striker running towards the goalie and trying to take him on, well, actually, you're the goalkeeping coach. So I actually went to Rafa and said, look, I've got the chart, and 1v1, I can do me box practice, you know, where goalie's in the middle of the box and passing it round, or rondo, I think they call it now, for goalkeeping. I can do me running this, you know, I can either shoot, take it round him, all the rest of it, but I really need outfield players. And to be fair, he was great. So once a week at least, we would do 1v1 with a team. Either 1v1, 2v1, 3v1, 3v2. And so he was actually compensating for the little bit that I actually couldn't do. Now, the argument to that would be, yeah, well, if you'd got outfield players, do you know what I mean? Then you could have done it with them. But he's the manager and we've got three other coaches. So I was always of the thought that they could do the outfield thing and I'll just make sure the goalkeepers are doing it right, for want of a better way of doing it. But as I say, as a learning experience, that was, well, it got me thinking again, really, because you do get in a routine, same people, goalkeeping 40 weeks a year. You know what you've got to do based on who we're playing next, what the individual strengths and weaknesses of the goalie are. But as I say, this just kind of all brought it together. I used to sit there and often think, this is a pain. 10 minutes short stubborn, 5 minutes. Do you know what I mean? But when you got at the end of the month, when you got the pie chart and you saw what it was, you think, oh, right, okay, I see where it's coming from now. Really did make you think about it.
So when you said there that you weren't as keen to work on crossing because of your own experiences in it, what does that mean then as a goalkeeper coach? Because you have to work on crossing.
No, you have to, but I think sometimes you're not as comfortable
right
dealing with things that as a goalie. And this brings me back into the discussion of, do you need to have played in the position to be a top coach? Now, I have varying ideas because obviously I've had Sir Bobby who was in his 60s, but still managed to join in. But the people like Sir Bobby, Don Howe, they had the ability to paint a picture without actually doing it themselves. Then we've kind of got into, and I'm going to go backwards here because what I was saying before, there is so many opportunities now, at differing levels from grassroots all the way through to be a goalkeeping coach, but they've never experienced playing. And I think it happened to me a little bit as well. As I said, in my younger days, I loved to join in, even though I wasn't that good, but as long as the lads were okay with it, if it gave them a breather or something to laugh about. But I always liked to join in. And in the early days, it did get me, because they didn't know who I was really, gave me a certain amount of credibility. But what it did for me in the end, so even up to the last season, I would join in the warm-up or rotational shooting, I then knew how they felt, like we said before, actually standing in the goal. Because when you're out there, either behind the net or at the side or out there, God, it looks easy. You know, it doesn't matter whether they're hitting at 50 miles an hour. So hopefully it looks easy. When you go in yourself, there's that thing of realization of like, oh, I've just asked him if he could have moved his feet and caught that, but now I've been in, I'm not so sure. And what worries me, as I say, because there are so many jobs available now, is that we're not going to have enough people to fulfill the jobs who have got the experience to do it.
Interesting, because there are, you know, we're seeing a huge wave of guys who didn't play at the highest level. You've got your Andrew Sparks, you've got your Ben Benson, you've got Xavi at Man City, you've got Marcus at Leeds, you've got so many of these guys who never played at the top level, but they've become students of goalkeeping.
And very good teachers. Mm. So a couple of them, obviously I know and have come through. I've coached them as a coaching coaches for the FA, get them through their awards. Well, obviously I never played at the highest level. I played a lot, but I didn't play at the highest level. It's like, well, how can you play for Gateshead, tell Shea Given who's playing in the Champions League, World Cup? What it's like, well, you can. And I think that's probably where it's about those people. What sprang when you said those people? My first thought was, yeah, but they're good teachers. Like Ben is an excellent teacher of the game, and they have the knowledge to back it up. Yeah, I mean, it's like that when you get to the man, it's like Arsene Wenger and people like that. They're great, they never played really. Rafa would be one, had to retire through a knee injury, but unbelievable teacher of the game, fantastic coach. And I asked Steve McLaren, who had at Newcastle. Excellent coach, really top coach. He had an okay career, but never really. And then you get the other side of it, like Ruud. So Ruud Gullit, he's best player in the world, or has been, but the lads didn't quite buy into him. So I saw that early on. Then I get Sir Bobby, who, as I say, could teach you, coach you anything without even doing it. So I've been really lucky that some of the people that I've worked with have all had a different strength, if you want. But for me, as I say, that's a slightly different subject, but then working for them and fitting yourself into their work ethic is like, okay, this might be interesting. Like Rafa being the classic one, where he's basically asking me to do something different. Still do the work, but actually produce something different, which will benefit me and the goalkeepers.
And it's all very well, isn't it, having all of that knowledge, like a Ruud Gullit, an example that you've mentioned there. You could sit here and have all the knowledge to be the best goalkeeper coach in the world. But if you don't have the ability to communicate that and articulate it and deliver it in a certain way, then that's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. So Bobby said to me one day, I'm standing behind the goal. I'm working with two excellent goalies. He said, Simon, if you don't speak, you're not doing yourself any favours and you're not doing them any favours. And out of all the things, Matt, that I've remembered from a coaching point of view, like has anybody ever given you a tip about coaching? That was it. Because when I first started, I was a bit overawed. I'll probably admit now, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was flying by the seat of my pants. I've got a lovely left foot. And he said to me one day, if you can shoot like Shearer and cross like Solano, we'll be fine. All right, okay, well, that's what I'm going to try and do then. I'm not saying I was as good as that, but I'm just saying that's the simple bit. But also you need to speak to them and tell them, and don't be afraid to tell them where they're going wrong or what they need to do. As I say, probably from a coaching tip from somebody, that's as good as I've ever had. I actually used that last week to a lad. Well, that's moving on slightly, but I watch now and I'm seeing unbelievable practices, which have actually gone actually too unbelievable. And I don't hear people coaching. They're that busy getting their mannequins in the right place, getting their service right, getting the people standing in the right place. When the actual practice starts, they don't speak. And I said, if you do nothing else for me, coach, speak to people and coach. As I say, whatever else you do, I'm not really bothered, but just pass your message on. If you see something, pass it on. And then last week I heard the best saying ever, which was drive by coaching. So okay. The FA obviously had a formula for years, was stop, stand still, let me show you. You identify it as a coach, you go in, you step in and say, could you have stepped, got your hands forward, get your head behind the ball, caught it. Let me show you. He throws the ball, you step across, catch it. Great. Now you have a go. I might throw it, I might volley it. Got the idea, got the pick. Yeah, great. Now that obviously takes time, doesn't it? And one thing as a goalkeeping coach, we don't really have a lot of the time, is time. So I had always done it by, while it's happening, I try and coach them while it's actually happening. So I can still get my message over, but while either they're in the queue to have their next go or they're having their next go, I can get my message over. Now described as drive-by coaching. I'm absolutely loving that because it describes it to a T. You know, like, I hate to say drive-by shooting, but It's like that. You keep going and the practice keeps going and the tempo of the practice and all the rest of it, but you're not stopping the tempo and stopping the flow of it. You're just doing it and getting your message over as it's happening. I thought, well, I'm having that.
Well, it's those fundamentals as well, right? And how they're, you know, translated in today's game. You've got your basics, your kicking, your punching, your catching, your collecting crosses. You've got certain drills that are the same, you know, your sidestep, touch the marker, set, catch, repeat, that sort of stuff. Open body stance with crosses, et cetera, lifting your knee up, all that sort of stuff for protection. But you've mentioned it there. There are now so many different ways of coaching a goalkeeper. I feel like you maybe feel like it's gone a bit too far.
Yeah, it has gone too far. There's no doubt about it. For me, with goalkeeping, there are only a certain, you've just mentioned them, there are actually only a certain amount of principles to it and they never change. So as you said in the intro, I wrote a book. So I was at university. I did 2 years at university. I failed. I had a year out in which I got involved with coaching for Barney Jones at the Northumberland Football Development Scheme. Nearly coached every day, great experience. And they said, oh, by the way, you can come back to uni. We've found a different way because you've got points now. It's a point system. You've got enough points to get back in, but you can't do a dissertation. Wasn't really that bothered about a dissertation. So I went back and they said, so what are you going to do? You have to do a project. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll write a goalkeeping book. And they've like looked at me as they go, yeah, right, okay. You're going to write a book. Having failed, he's going to write a book. Cut a long story short, there was an organisation called the National Coaching Foundation. The lad I played for Gateshead with was either in charge or second in command. And I went to him, I said, look, I'm thinking of writing a goalkeeping book. There aren't that many out there, apart from Shilton in goal, Clements on keeping, Southall on whatever. I'm going to write one. Right, okay, you know what you're doing. Yeah, I know what I need to do from an educational point of view, review of literature, all the rest of it. Went on holiday to France, took every book on goalkeeping that I could find in the library that I had myself, like I say, Clements in goal, Shilton on keeping, Alan Wade's FA goalkeeping book, which is a little booklet thing. Looked through them all and then thought, they're all saying the same. So whether it's from 1962 to at the time, 1990, whatever it was, in 1997, 8, they were all saying, and it may be in slightly a different way, but they were all saying the same. There are only 8 or 9 aspects of goalkeeping. All right, okay. So did my own book. Yeah, managed to get it published. It then gets on the FA's list of books to, you know, reference books, resource, whatever it is. Great. I loved it. Then made the DVDs. Very basic. Well, people would call them basics, fundamentals, well received. The only ones I had were Franz Hook, who was a great teacher of goalkeeping. Unbelievable. I mean, really was like, you're saying about inspiration for coaching would be Franz. I looked at his. thought, yeah, great save. Practices, though. Bit of coaching, but practices. I thought, I'll just do one for pure, well, basically what you need to do to be a goalie. And then the funny thing with it, Matt, is that it's kind of taken off. And it's like, people have now got completely, in my opinion, obsessed by, and I'm not saying goalkeeping coaches, but I'm saying coaches playing out from the back, playing through the, and I'm involved in this, by the way, because playing through the thirds from the FA, I helped write. So it's like, you had a bit of an influence in this. And that's overtaken actually stopping the ball going in the goal. So it's like, so all I'm hearing is about him playing through the thirds, playing out from the back, picking a pass, knowing where your players are. Yeah, if it's a goal kick, well, I pass it to him, he passes it back. It's like playing by numbers. I'll go, in fact, I tell you what, get the defender to take the goal kick. I'll go and stand over there. And I'm not being funny now because I've had the time to watch. The number of times now, Matt, I see the goalie kick it to the centre back, who does exactly the same as the goalie used to when you put the ball on one side, is absolutely amazing. And people are saying, oh, wow, have you looked at this? But now what started to happen, it started to change a little bit because there's a risk and reward. Like, we all want to play out from the back. We all want to keep position. We all like to play by Man City. But he has players at Manchester City who can play out from the back. I was going to give you an example, but there's other teams who can't but think they can. And that's where it's getting a mismatch. So all of a sudden, we've taken this on board. So that's one area that's kind of overtaken. Then people have started to say, great playing out from the back, but they've had three shots to the team and they've scored three times and he hasn't got near any ball. What's a goalie doing? Well, maybe if you stop thinking about playing out of the back and concentrate on the ball going in the goal, then, you know, you might have a different... So I'm not saying forget that bit and concentrate on this bit, but what I'm saying is that for me, the focus has been on passing and receiving. And all of a sudden, people have... And it's like everything else. People want to find a new method, don't they? So like I was saying to you before, the stop, stand still, let me show you has been a coaching method. I did that, but I also did drive-by coaching, right? So I didn't stop it. I just carried on, but got my message over. So trying to find that happy medium. And then all of a sudden, somebody decided, I tell you what, let's not do that at all. Let the game be the teacher. What a great idea is that? And I tell you what, you just put the game on. You don't even have to coach because they're learning themselves. And I looked into that as an educational process. Excellent. When somebody's shooting the ball at you at 70 miles an hour, it's not a good idea. Oh, put little Johnny in. I'm going to kick this at you at 50 miles an hour. How are you going to stop it going in the goal? And then all of a sudden, he's broken two fingers or it's hit him in the face and he never wants to play in goal ever again. So that whole thing is, for me, has, we've kind of, I think we've lost our way a little bit. But what has been really interesting, I'm doing these micro groups for the FA, is that all the feedback I'm getting is, and this isn't because of the FA, this is because that course is set up for a different level, is we need to get back to basics. Because I'm seeing we're getting goalies through at 13, 14, 15 who don't have the basics. And the other side of that, Matt, is if you look now, and I've had time to do it, if you look at the goals that people concede, I'm going to say at least 80%, and it might be higher, are a technical error. And I'm not saying about the build-up. I'm not saying about the cross. I'm saying actual. If you just put the camera now or the drone, which is the thing now, on top of there, and you just looked at somebody in that goal, when the ball goes past them, or 80 or 90% of the are a technical error. And it's frightening because it's like, it's nobody telling them. There's nobody working on that. And to be fair, I worry that some people aren't, that they're not, because they've gone so far into this other, and I'm going to say it, YouTube doesn't help. So if I'm a young coach and I want advice and I want help, where do I get my session? Where do I get my practices? I'll go on YouTube. And he clicks on YouTube. And the first practice is some German athlete of a goalie leaping over two pieces of string and making 14 repetitive saves. So I'll do that with the kids next week. Ah, right, okay. Absolutely of no use whatsoever apart from tiring the kid out and probably actually putting him off goalkeeping. And that's what I'm seeing. And I find it quite worrying. You know, and as I say, one of the things of this micro group thing, I maybe should say this, but is that you go and watch other people coach, which is fantastic. And then in the nicest way, you feed back on what you've seen. And all the things that they talk about is it realistic? Does it reflect the game? Is it realistic? And like I have to say, some of them I go and it's like, not really, you've got too much going on. And now it's funny, before you came this morning, I was thinking about that. To be a goalkeeping coach and to be a goalie, I think you've got to be quite boring because it's repetitive. And it should be repetitive. People go, repetition. It's become the word repetition has become like in modern coaching has become like a swear word. But no, actually, it's the whole position is based on repetition. Can you repeat the action under pressure, in high speed, all the rest of it, consistently? Going back to what does the manager look consistent? That's what people want, consistency. We were talking about this the other day. Somebody was asking me about what did you do for pre-season when you were in Newcastle? I said, I took him to play tennis. Like, sorry? I took him to play tennis? Because if you look at the game of tennis, footwork, positioning, moving your feet, it was, in so many ways, it replicates. I was saying this to somebody the other day, and it was actually Paul Winsper, who obviously fitness, he said, yeah. He said, it's funny that he said, when I worked for Nike, he said, Roger Federer came to do a promo thing in Portland. I said, yeah. I said, well, fantastic. You know, and I was retired, fantastic. He said, yeah. He said, it was really funny, though. He said, he came to do this promotion. He had a few photos today, and then he disappeared. And they're like, people, you know, they're flustering. Like, well, where's Roger gone? Where's Roger gone? And then somebody like looked out the window. He said, oh, he's on that court over there. Anyway, cut long story short, he played tennis against this bloke for 4 hours. So he's gone to take it for a photo shoot. And when Paul said to him, so you played tennis for 4 hours? He went, yeah, that's really my training. I just repeat the game over and over and over again. Yeah, sometimes I might do a bit of footwork and there's obviously a physical side to it. But to be fair, I'm not sure he was really into that because he was a natural athlete, if there's such a thing. But he just played the game. But it's like, so from a goalkeeping point of view, I always took it, like I'm saying, shoot legs here, cross legs along. Just put that into a practice that is interesting. Don't get me wrong, I'm not looking for boring. I'm looking for interesting, but is relevant and realistic and has the same kind of tempo and as they have to do in the game. Now, you can't reproduce the thing in front of 50,000. That's the bit. But if they repeat it that much and it's a learned behaviour, it doesn't matter who's watching you. I used to say to Martin, when he runs on the pitch and they shake hands and all the rest of it, and then when he runs to the Gallagher end and everybody claps and he applauds, and it's not just Martin, I would be in tears. But he loves it. He thrives on it. And I was saying to him, I said, Martin, how do you do it? Have you got a, like a trick to keep yourself? And we went, and he looked at me, he was like, I was stupid. No, I don't need a trick. I don't need a trick. Well, I would. Maybe that's why I'm the coach and not the player. So there's bits wrapped up in it, not just from a technical point of view, but that was one of the things of taking the fear out of it. So obviously we had match analysis. So when Beckham was at Man United, he'd scored a goal where the ball came across the box, he hit it first time and it bent round in the far corner of the net. And so in the meeting, I said to Shea, look, obviously you don't want to frighten them with the analysis, like show 97 goals Man United have scored. And then they come out a massive, God, it's Man United every time they shoot this goal. So obviously doing it real. And anyway, so I showed him it. We actually had a go, even though I'm left footed. We had a go and I've hit a ball and he's made a save and it's like, yeah, great, carry on. And then on a Saturday at Old Trafford, and it was honestly, Matt, I'm not just saying this, it was like, he'd pick the screen up the telly, ball comes in, he comes into the box, not marked, hits a ball, comes across and bends it lovely and shady, gets across, tips it round. So obviously I'm sitting there, oh, this is great, what a great job this is. So getting the changing room after the game, I said to Shea, I said, hey, what about Beckham's shot? And he like, oh. And then after about like 30 seconds, he went, oh, that was a bit like the one you hit yesterday. And it's like, I'm not going to go there, but do you know what I mean? It's like, we've done it, I've shown you, whether you realise it or not, but anything you could do that took the fear out of what they were facing or what they were going to have to do was the way that I went about it. And, you know, I think one of your things before was about, I never thought I had any principles on goalkeeping. I thought I just did goalkeeping. But now I would have to say that I would describe myself as a technical coach because I am. But again, and I'm not saying that because I am, I'm saying because to me, you can't get away from the importance of it. You know, it's like, well, why do you need a specialist coach? Because you have specialist skills. They don't play anybody in goal. They only play people in goal who have the skill to play in goal and the specialist skill. That's why you need a specialist coach. All the other bits of football are in football in general. You know, the set play, that's slightly different in America. Or I get kind of that to have somebody be a, but that's maybe a specialist thing, like goalkeeping, because it is a specialist thing. But what we've actually tried to go away from that. I think sometimes, and I'm not sure where it's coming from. I'm not sure whether it comes abroad. the lads at Newcastle's goalkeeping squad, Tony Kaig at the academy, and have been to Feyenoord. And what they do up till the age of eight, I think he said eight or nine, is that they play anybody in goal. And when I had my little trip to Canada for a year, that was the same there. They let everybody have a go in goal. It was like, you know, let's see if you like the position and all the rest of it. And I'm wondering where some of that is becoming from, as I say, from abroad, that kind of not specialising. The thing that gets me about that is that Man United needed an under-9 goalie. And you can't just say, oh, go on then, Tom, it's your turn today, get yourself in. Because there's a league and it's Man United and there's an importance to it. So you need to teach people. I'm not saying you need to, maybe I am. Yeah, I just think, as I say, because it's got its own set of skills. So, and that's where I'll go to. We are going to produce within the next, from what I've seen, in probably 3 or 4 years, some goalies who are unbelievably good with their feet. And then we need to make sure that they're also very good at stopping it going in the goal. Because when I go and watch the academy play or academies play, I'm seeing some lovely people who play with their feet. And to be fair, I'm also seeing some decent goalies, but they're few and far between, Matt, where they've got the whole package. So I'm seeing people who are good in goal, average with their feet, excellent with their feet, average as goalies. And to be fair, you're still getting that at the higher levels.
So how do you find that balance then? Because if we take this weekend, we spoke about it earlier, Jason Steele at the Emirates yesterday as of the time of recording. And I don't know whether I'm getting carried away here, but that is one of the as close to flawless performances with a goalkeeper with the ball at his feet that I can recall seeing. He was absolutely brilliant yesterday. But there is a goalkeeper who is, what, 30 plus now. So I'm presuming he would have learned the fundamentals as you're describing them, the basics of goalkeeping, and then learned to play with the ball at his feet.
Great example. Was always good with his feet. Always had a reputation as a lovely striker of a ball. What the clever bit is for me is that they've learned to play. And it's a bit like, so he's got the technique. Nice on the ball, really comfortable receiving, passing, short distance, long distance. Before side volleying became a thing, always had a lovely side volley. But what for me, what the clever bit is how they've managed to then fit that into a game. And what worries me is that we're trying to fit things into a game that aren't. You have to organize, and this is where I think there's a bit of a mishmash. So you get an outfield coach who wants to play an expansive out from the back, but you need a goalie who can do that. And I'm not sure. I think sometimes they're that blinkered by wanting to play in that way. Sometimes when they get a goalie who doesn't quite fit, it doesn't quite work. Do you know what I'm trying to say? And then do you adapt your team then? You know, I was saying before, so you're asking people, so what did you look for in a goalie? And the answer I get normally from scouts is, how tall is he and how far he can kick it? That's the first question that I get. Even now, when we're in a technical and learning and all the bit, that's all they're bothered about. How big is he and how far can he kick it? Say, what? Well, do you not want to play out from the back? Yeah. Well, why are you asking me how far he can kick it then? There's still a, I don't know what the word is, disparagement. There's so much that isn't joined up. But the way I looked at it, whether right or wrong, is I tried to teach them so they could do everything. So what do you need to do in a game? So going back to my clock, I then added on passing and receiving. I mean, the classic mat is now, can you clip a ball from middle of the goal to the wide, either fullback or midfield player? That's all you need. I'm not saying, when I watched the World Cup, they said, what was the themes about the World Cup? Every goalie had a pass from the middle of the goal to either a wide midfield player or a wide fullback. That was like the standard pass. I didn't see people, what I'm going to say, the majority of the time, you didn't see like the goalie playing it in the midfield player, getting it back, playing it wide. A bit like you see Man City sometimes, but he's got the players and the organisation to do that, and the goalie. You know, I always look, I think it's really interesting when the other one plays, you see the similar, but it's not quite the same. And again, what's happened there, and the thing that it was the art of throwing disappeared. Because you needed these passes, there was no throwing. So the art of throwing, which used to be, if you think of Schmeichel, Barthez, Van der Sar, unbelievable throwers of a ball, or even Gerrard bring it in the end because he learned how to do it. Fantastic throwers of a ball, accurate, can roll it in front of you, can roll it to you, high, throw it over people. that had gone because it was all this playing with my feet. But I've noticed it's just starting to come back. In the World Cup, there was actually some decent throwers of a ball. I'm not saying it's going full circle, but because you're right, it is evolving. But you're now probably, what I'm thinking is you need a larger skill set.
Well, that's a key thing, isn't it? And that's as a goalkeeper coach, especially, again, for you who's come through this period, you know, the 30-odd year period where you've had the likes of, you mentioned Edwin van der Sar there, you've had Pepe Reina who came in with a sidewinder all of a sudden. So as a goalkeeper, you're having to adapt new skills and manage both a goalkeeper's and a manager's perspective from that as well and their expectation.
And I think that's been probably been the challenge. It's not reinventing the wheel. Like I said before, I think it's just making sure that they've got the skill set. But then, like you said before, Matt, the other side of it is having that relationship with them and building, getting them to buy into what you're, you know, because especially if the manager says something. You know, we had a lad called Matt Sells and who came with Rafa, got him from Belgium, and he's Belgium's number two, three, whatever. Rafa said to him one day, "Oh, you need to practice your punching." Because I didn't say it. So when I then put on the practices, he didn't buy into what I was trying to do with him. That's always an interesting, that relationship thing. And as I say, I've worked for several managers where some have involved me and some haven't in the bigger decisions. But now I look back, I can understand. So that relationship you have where you are their goalkeeping coach, but you still have a responsibility as the manager. And I think sometimes if they ever thought that I picked who played, that would just kill me. So the people I'm thinking about, the managers, sorry, I'm thinking about, have done unbelievably well of keeping me out of those decisions, even though internally they're always asking opinion. Like every day after training, they would always say, "Oh, how are the goalies this morning?" Or I say, "Oh, I love, yeah, great," or "some sort of didn't fancy it," or whatever. And then they would reply what they were like with their sessions. So obviously there was that picture building. But then when it came to picking who played, obviously your feedback through the time would be hopefully invaluable, but they then made that decision. If they ever thought it was me, that would just kill the whole thing because then you've got a favourite. And I think I read an article about 18 months ago by Claudio Bravo at Man City about only one can play. Because obviously he had a bit of a talk where he went and he played and then they brought Edison, and it was excellent, like from a goalkeeper's perspective, of the fact that only one can play, but it's up to you to keep training as much as you can because you never know when you might play, supporting the other one, but doing it for yourself. And I thought, oh, I'm having that. And to be fair, I've used it a couple of times. Well, even if you're playing, there's somebody else behind you. And obviously I've been unbelievably lucky because I had Shea and Harps. And if it hadn't been for Harps, Shea wouldn't have been so good. And then I had Martin and Carl. It was the same, similar kind. And to be fair, that even before that, I had Tim Krul and Robbie Elliott. I've always been lucky that I've had a number two that has been one able to play at a very, very similar standard to the one who's playing and has pushed without being, you know, arsy about it, has always supported and pushed the one who's playing. Yeah, so, I mean, somebody said to me the other day, it's about creating that learning and working environment that everybody's kind of happy on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, on a Saturday one, they're not going to be that happy because only one can play. And that's always been I've always found that dynamic and interesting, and probably more interesting because I played every week. Do you know what I mean?
So yeah, of course.
Player, it's like, oh, have you ever dropped? No, not that I can remember. So do you really know what the other one's feeling? And it wasn't until much later, to be fair, I'd finished Gateshead and I'd semi-retired. And I went back to play for Whitley Bay and I enjoyed it, but I was really getting into the coaching. And anyway, I was playing for Whitley Bay, but I was enjoying playing. And then they got a new manager and he dropped me for somebody who he'd had at another club. So he basically brought his own goalie. And that also stood me in good stead because I knew then what it was like when somebody brought somebody else who they'd had. And that was always, you know, if somebody said, "Well, what didn't you like about being a goalkeeping coach?" That was the thing that I didn't like, I hated, made me feel ill, was that moment when the manager left and there was a new manager coming and the thought of, is he going to bring his own goalkeeping coach? Is he going to like me? You know, that kind of, what's the word? Not indecision, it's like they're not knowing.
Anxiety, really, yeah.
Anxiety, yeah. And they, I have to say, it was a real mix because the first time it happened, so Bobby left, John Carver took, who was one of my
best friends really in football, took over as the caretaker manager. So I had that. So I'm like, I'm supporting John, which is great. And I'm loving it. And there's like two gated lads sitting on the thing. But then the fear of not knowing what's happening next. And then I had, towards the end, Graham Jones took over. I got to know really well and great. And I had the same, Graham took over. And it happened to me at Carlisle many years ago when I was probably the first time where manager left, the coach took over who was great. I got on with really well. And you want them to do well, but you know there's going to be somebody else coming. Who is he bringing his own man or is he not? If somebody said, what is the part of the job that you don't like, that would be the, like you say, the anxiety of it is like the not knowing whether you're going to be sacked, whether you're going to be out of a job within 2 weeks or, and that, I mean, I had that this, not this year, but the year before when, so we were told that when Rafa left, it was going to be Unai Emery. Now I know that Unai Emery brings Xavi because I've got to know Xavi a little bit. So it's like, well, I know he's coming. So I had that time where it's like, oh, you know, I'm soon to lose my wife, I'm going to be looking for a job. And it's not that easy to get another job in the Premier League, mm-hmm. you know. And I'm trying to explain to her, why wouldn't they keep you? You've been there that long and you're doing all right. No, he's bringing his own man. And that's a bit of an interesting thing to get your head around as well. It's like, well, am I not doing a good job then? Am I not? No, it's because it's who I always have. And I can get that, you know, because I often say, oh, if Graham got a job, I'd love to go with him. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And I think, oh, but that's taking somebody else's job. So as I say, those were the times where, and then obviously didn't come. So he doesn't come. And then they get a new manager. And then it's like, what's he going to do? So like for 3 or 4 weeks, it's like, I'm like that. And all the time you've got to go in. And for the lads, you've just got to be like that. As though you're not bothered. Well, I'm just coaching you and you're the most important thing to me and playing well on a Saturday. And yeah, I've said it before, Matt, I don't think people realise. And I hope sometimes by things that I've been able to say that people realise that it's not as easy as just turning up and kicking a ball. I like to make it out to it is, you know, it's like, I kick it, you catch it. Yeah, I think, I'm not going to say in the end that got too much for me, but the all those other bits that surround it, which people think are quite glamorous, are really quite tough. And I'm not doing a woe is me here because I love the job and it's the best job in a way. It wasn't really a job. But as I say, people don't realise what there is behind it. And also, I'm not just saying for goalkeeping, I'm saying for all staff in that position. You know, people used to turn up to the game and say, oh, I used to come watch you warm up. And you think, hey, is that lovely? You know, somebody's come to watch us warm up, but they don't know what goes on behind to get to that, even that warm up, what you've gone through with the lads. And as I say, because I've had time to sit and think about it, you know, like how much time have I wasted sitting in an afternoon waiting for the manager to speak to me? Yeah, probably about 6 years. Do you know what I mean? But they don't see that. They just see that. And that's why I've really enjoyed the thing for the FA, because I've gone and I've talked about goalkeeping and I've watched goalkeeping and I've talked to 5 other people about goalkeeping who, yeah, might be younger than me, but it's great to get what they're thinking. And then it's like up to me to think, well, what can I do? Do I do another book? Do I do a video? Do I do a website? Do I do whatever to try and help these people? Because I still want to try and help people to be coaches and give the message and do all the rest of it. I can't quite, you know, Lucy keeps saying to me, are you going to retire? And I think, well, no. You know, I still sit on a night sometimes with me ball and me gloves on the city watching the telly. And it's like, Simon, he's 60 years of age.
With your ball and gloves?
Yeah. I've got a reputation of that. I hope because I love the gloves so much. I really am an anorak. Is that I'll sit on the night and like hold the ball and put the gloves on and get it.
When you're watching the game?
No, just be watching ordinary telly. That is my one kind of odd. But that's why I never answer the phone quick enough because I've taken my glove off. So people will ring me and right on the last ring, I'll go, hello. And people who know me really well say, trying to get your glove off, really.
I mean, that's new. Just yeah, well, regular
it's like
TV.
That. It's like that. Well, somebody once said to me, even if I was lucky with the FA, I worked with people who did let me have a go with outfield players. So even if I'm working with a back four or a midfield with a goalie, I always used to wear my gloves. And then one day, a coach who has passed away now, Dick Bate, who was a legend in coaching, said to me, why don't you take your gloves off? I said, well, they're actually my comfort blanket. Because I know when I've got my gloves on, I know what I'm talking about. And I feel comfortable because that's what I normally do when I coach, I wear gloves. And this is I'm going to have another rant now, but this is why I don't understand why some goalkeeping coaches don't wear gloves. It's like, hang on a sec. But again, I'm saying that I do because in the nicest possible way, they may be coming from a different direction, i.e. probably have never played or haven't played, or they feel more comfortable without the gloves. Or is it then because, oh, then the manager will think, or the coach will think that I'm only goalkeeping?
I think that is a big part of it. Because I think, and especially I've heard this from goalkeeper coaches that I've spoken to, have their gloves on when they're doing the goalkeeper side of things. But then when it becomes the goalkeepers being integrated in to the outfielder and in your set plays and stuff, they take the gloves off because then there isn't that separation.
It's an interesting. As I say, I always kept mine on because they were a comfort blanket. So I always felt more comfortable with them on. It's like, all right, okay. Keep them on. Saying the right thing. But yeah.
Hi, everyone. So that is the first part, the first three quarters, I suppose, of Simon Smith done and dusted. There is a little bit more where he goes on to talk about working with the likes of Martin Dubravka, with Pavel Cernicek, with Sir Bobby Robson, some great tales he tells in that section of the podcast. But we thought we'd just leave it for a smaller, more bite-sized podcast, which we shall release next week. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. On to the next one.